For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Thank you all, and may the merit of our chanting be of great benefit to all beings. So, actually, in exploring, as we just chanted the Heart Sutra, I thought I might start with a quote from Carl Brunholz, a scholar teaching in the Siddhartha Institute up in Washington. And he had this to say, let's see. About the Heart Sutra, it says, in brief, if we have never seen the Heart Sutra and we read it, it sounds crazy because it just keeps saying no, no, no. And if we are trained in Buddhism, it also sounds crazy, maybe even more so, because it negates everything that we have learned and tried to cultivate. So, that's the Heart Sutra. And so we'll try to explore why it says no, 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 and seemingly negating these core Buddhist teachings. Just want to check how many of you have some familiarity with the text. Yeah, a few of you a little touched on it. And actually, maybe before we really get into it, maybe why don't we go around the names first? Sorry for forgetting that. I'm Hakusho.
David.
Steven.
David.
Chris.
Patient. Kathy.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Yeah. People have questions about the Heart Sutra, just you know, from chanting it now, or you know, that's sort of been carrying. It's welcome to bring them up now, and we'll see if we can answer some of them during the seminar between all of us. Yeah.
I'm just curious if it's known who wrote the Heart Sutra and when.
Yeah. I hope to go into... Yeah. The short answer is no, I think.
Okay.
But there's some different theories of... Yeah. Where, actually, at least, yeah. Might have been written.
After the first sentences, all of the rest of it understood to be in the voice of Avalokiteshvara.
Oh, you mean as a like who wrote it or
well,
or is it a question?
The first sentence is,
yeah.
Sariputra, form is not the end. Is that like a quote? Is that?
Yeah, I think it's commonly read as this is Avalokiteshvara transmitting
same,
the.
Same message.
Yeah, yeah. Stephen.
What is the skandha?
Oh, it's... I'll get into that too, yeah. Yeah, so I'll make sure I'll touch on that. I'm just going to take the questions and I'll refrain the answers. Okay, well, if you have more questions as the seminar goes on, please raise your hands or speak out. So the Heart Sutra is part of a collection of texts known as the Prajnaparamita literature, or the Perfection of Wisdom literature. And these vary in great length. The very shortest one is just the letter A. It has the introduction of this most sutras to you, of thus have I heard, the Blessed One was once blah, 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 you know, sitting in, you know, where the Buddha was teaching, etc. And then he proclaimed A, and then you have the... effect or appreciation of the Sangha, you know, upon this. And the longest one is the Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 lines, which is 12 big books, yeah, of text. So, yeah. And it's thought, usually most commonly thought, that this is the perfection of in 8,000 lines, which is the most, the oldest one of these texts, which appeared around somewhere in the first century before the Common Era. So about 400 years after the life of the Buddha. Although the Diamond Sutra, which is maybe the second most influential of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, is also believed to be really early, and possibly even earlier than that. And these are some of the earliest Mahayana Sutras to appear. Mahayana being a school of Buddhism that Zen grew out of, or belongs to, placing emphasis on the emptiness teachings and the path of the Bodhisattva. And the Heart Sutra, the earliest, you know, record existing, you know, sort of proof of it is actually found in China rather than in India, and it's not until 649 Common Era that appears. And we'll go deeper into the significance of, you know, of that in a bit. Also, as we explore the sutra, to say that it's the general understanding is that it's a reaction to one of the predominant schools at the time, and it's the chanting. You know, it's all these core concepts and how they interpreted it. And the Buddha, the Heart Sutra, part of the know is to turn those teachings upside down a little bit. Can you all hear me? Anyway, so and so. Okay, I'll try to speak up over the AC. So there's several unusual features in this sutra compared to most other sutras in general, and to the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. Anybody have some sense of what some of them might be? Is this something that strikes you as unusual about the Heart Sutra?
Just the way it kind of goes through all the, I mean, each of the major sort of chunks of the earlier teachings, the four truths, and the Nidanas, and all those things, it sort of says.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. Also, it mentions Bodhisattvas, so it seems like it combines Theravada and Mahayana.
Hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't start with "thus have I heard."
Right.
Meaning that, it's not claiming to be potentially, I don't know, like the direct word of the Buddha.
Yeah, that's very uncommon for a sutra. Yeah. Anything else? They are, you know, Bodhisattvas in the Mahayana Sutra, so it's not uncommon in that setting. Yeah, as a Mahayana Sutra, that's not a distinguishing feature, but it is for it being a Perfection of Wisdom text. It's very unusual to have the Avalokiteshvara, is the Bodhisattva of Compassion, being it's the only time that he or she actually appears teaching throughout the literature. I think it, as far as mentioned, you know, it's in the assembly somewhere, but I think it's about the only teaching. So it's very unusual. And also it doesn't have the other, usually in the Perfection of Wisdom, it's either the Buddha or Subhuti is teaching, and neither of them make an appearance at all in this sutra. And it also doesn't lack a conclusion. It ends in an unusual way. You know, usually there's a reference to the reaction of the audience upon hearing the teachings. There's not. Instead, it ends with this mantra instead, which is another unusual feature of the sutra. So to go into the history of it, up until recently, the common sort of understanding has been that the sutra originated in India and spread, like the other Prajnaparamita sutras, from there. But that it had little influence in India, and it was in China that it became really popular. And as I said, it didn't show up until about 649, and it was largely influence of one monk, Xuanzang, who's believed to have gone on pilgrimage from China to India, and he chanted the Heart Sutra repeatedly and believed it to have protective powers, and he also made his own translation, which is now the earliest record of it. Is what we have is Xuanzang's translation that's dated to 649 Common Era. Once it gained popularity in China, it spread and it became, you know, the basis, you know, very central to Zen schools in particular, and it's chanted in Soto Zen monasteries every morning for morning service. There's also,
in that history, if it was first translated from Sanskrit to Chinese, is that right?
Yeah.
The 7th century?
Yeah.
Then before that time, is it assumed that it was in oral tradition and used in the temples or wherever, by sadhus, leading up to that time?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it wasn't influential in India, because there's this, you know, this little record, you know, or this sort of little indications more, but not really any conclusive proof of being actually the same sutra, you know, existing. There's also a longer version of the sutra, which does have the... That's how I heard, and the conclusion at the end. But it's that definitely showed up later, and it appears more to have been, an add-on to sort of make it just establish the authority of it, and not what the standard text was about. And then in the early 2000s, there was some sort of groundbreaking scholarship that turned this common understanding of the history a little up on its head, but Jan Natier, and she starts by dividing the sutra into three sections. So it's the, you know, if you're looking at the text, you have the introduction, which is, you know, the perspective of Avalokiteshvara. Practicing Prajnaparamita and perspective on the emptiness of the five skandhas, and then the core in which addressing all these observations to Shariputra, and then the conclusion where it goes into a bodhisattva who relies on the perfection of wisdom, you know, and the mantra, all of this. And then she goes on from there to observe that the core section, you know, which starts basically at, you know, form is not other than emptiness, and all the way down to no knowledge and no attainment, is virtually identical to a passage in what's called a large sutra, which is the perfection of 25,000 lines. I don't think she discover this, but the conclusion of that is that of these two texts, the Large Sutra and the Heart Sutra, one of them must have sort of come out of the other, because the similarities so startling. And usually it's assumed that the Large Sutra was, you know, clearly originated in India and it was translated into Chinese, and then that the Heart Sutra originated in India and was translated into Chinese, and that the Indian Heart Sutra would have come out of, most likely come out of the Large Sutra. Is that, sorry, following me so far? It was a little convoluted. But examining the four texts, it's actually surprising findings that the two Chinese texts, so the Chinese Heart Sutra and Large Sutra, are virtually identical in content and in words used, whereas the Sanskrit text, the content is the same, but the language is very different, and the grammar, etc. So the conclusion she's drawing from that, the suggestion is then that the Sanskrit Heart Sutra might actually be what's called a back translation, translated from the Chinese into Sanskrit. So the history of the text would be the Large Sutra first appearing in India, it being translated into Chinese, somebody then pulling this core section, pulling this part, what's the core section in the Heart Sutra, out of there, adding the beginning and the end of it, and then it making itself back into India. And it's actually, then that she's calling her article a Chinese apocryphal text. And if you look at some of the analogies of the text, like we just mentioned, not having a proper opening and a conclusion, and the Avalokiteshvara is showing up, all of these are actually occurring exclusively in the beginning and the opening, not in the core section of it. So there would be another explanation of why, sort of strengthening the argument that it might be a Chinese text initially with these parts added on. And the surprising thing, about that then is that why, if the Heart Sutra was created in China, why didn't they make more of an effort to make it look like a sutra? There are some other sutras in the Mahayana canon that scholars have actually found originated in China rather than in India. But they've done a pretty good, really good job at trying to make it look like follow the structure. And here they clearly didn't do that. The suspicion around that is that it actually wasn't, it never was a sutra to begin with. It was should be understood as a Dharani scripture, a text to be recited and chanted, and as a mnemonic device for these core teachings, but not actually as a sutra. That's why there wasn't this effort to make it appear like one. It was had more of an intention for ritual use. And as Xuanzang, on his pilgrimage, believed this to have some protective powers, it was seems to have been actually how the Heart Sutra came to grow and influence, was some belief in it having some powers. So, and I think neither, of these theories of the origins of it are clearly established. It's quite possible that the initial Sanskrit version just got lost, which is what commonly was believed. But I wanted to mention it, and if anybody's interested, it's a fascinating article. A little scholarly, but not overly so, and I'd be happy to email it to any of you.
If it were a Dharani text, it would be very different than most Dharani texts, right? In that there is like a clear content. I mean, a lot of times Dharani texts, for the most part, don't have this kind of expository quality, like they're
sometime, and I, you know, she says that sometimes the distinction is, like, the Dharani does have some content to it, at least originally, but it might have been transliterated into different languages, and then it's all a mantra, but that it has some origin of being actually in the teachings, that, whereas a mantra is more sounds than what you're saying. Yeah. But I think it's interesting just the way that the sutra is being related to now. It actually kind of functions as both, you know, it has this Dharani text and it is chanted in Soto monasteries all over. And we're having this seminar on it now, and there's been more commentaries written on the Heart Sutra than any other Mahayana text. So it has... yeah.
Well, and we treat it like a Dharani text. You know, we do one right. syllable per beat, and we use
yeah.
kugyo, and, you know, unlike many texts of chant.
Yeah. So it's got both the... And there's the teachings in there, too. And we... You know, when we will chant the, you know, later we'll chant the Japanese transliteration of the Chinese, which I think didn't make much sense to Japanese either, but it's been chanted like this for, you know, 800 years, something like that, and, you know, and even longer going back into China. So then it's even more of a Dharani text. And we can treat it as a sutra too and reflect on the teachings in there.
What's the term you use?
Dharani, yeah.
Dharani.
Yeah, it's a... yeah, I think it's similar to a mantra, but it has some... well, there's one definition of it anyway. It's something that you're chanting, but it's got some, at least some origin in something that makes sense, you know, in the teachings. Whereas a mantra is more, you know, sounds and some belief in... the healing, or, you know, the power of these sounds themselves, but there's some content, at least from the beginning, in a Dharani. That's my understanding of it, and it's not
part of this Dharani is the what's called the mantra at the end, is that what you're saying? Just the end of the...
Yeah, and then there's a puzzling thing too. Yeah, but we treat the whole text as a Dharani. Yeah, in the way that we're chanting it, and, you know, using it ritually. Yeah. So, and when we're in service, then it's a Dharani text. But and when we're having a seminar right now, then we're treating it. Right now, we're treating it as a sutra. Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about this differs from other sutras as far as, you know, the beginning and then the core and then the end.
Yeah.
How are other? I really don't know how other sutras are really done. What makes this different when you say it is different, but what makes it different? Because, you know, you say it's the beginning and then you get to the core and then the end, but how is it? Oh. What is the difference between this and something else?
Well, Jan Etier's reason for dividing into three different pieces was to show that the core section is identical to this longer text, and all the unusual features about the Heart Sutra, you know, about Avalokiteshvara teaching and not having a proper beginning or ending, you know, the Buddha and Subhuti, those are in those two sections that she divides it into. And the core section is just lifted from this other text. So that would be, it's an argument to show that, yeah, that these two pieces might have originated elsewhere and that maybe it wasn't intended as a sutra from the beginning.
The sutras, I'm not sure if it's mistaken. I thought sutras were supposed to be the words of the Buddha.
Yeah, and that's why they usually start with "Thus have I heard." And for the Pali Canon, that's what we, you know, there's some reason to believe that that was actually so. But all the Mahayana sutras most definitely were not the words of the Buddha, but they are written as if they were. You know, it was a way to give these texts authority, and the words of the Buddha have, you know, the highest authority. And there's only one Mahayana sutra that's, I think, not really claiming to be the words of the Buddha, which is the Platform Sutra, the sixth ancestor in China. And that's also, calling it a sutra is giving it authority, lifting it up as being equal to the words of the Buddha in some way. But that's it's a side.
So I think culturally, like when these sutras are being either collected or created, or how is, I don't know if this is a question and an answer to, but like how is that culturally received when it's a group of monks or Buddhist scholars, like you're saying creating a text to give it this appearance of this is authoritative and put it like what does putting it in the Buddhist voice imply, basically, in terms of its cultural, standing, does this question make sense, or its authority, why is it claiming to be used for excitement, is the best way to...
Yeah, I mean, I think if you succeed and making the argument that this is the Buddha's voice, then it gives the text more weight, if it's, it's hiding that it was just some, some monk, it's a lot of these Mahayana sutras they believe actually grew out, it wasn't like it was a separate school already, but there was monasteries with monks practicing, and maybe some of them would be more drawn to and think there was too much of a focus on the monastic and the sort of scholastic, and these Mahayana sutras actually growing out within the same institutions, but then attributed to the Buddha to give them weight rather than there being some monk that thought that their school was kind of taking a bit of a wrong turn and trying to correct it. And the Heart Sutra was, let me get into this now, a reaction to the Sarvastivada audience, which was the most influential school in that part of Northern India, at least at the time, and very scholastic. Just to say something about that school, so during the Buddha's life, he gave teachings, he was concerned with suffering and the relief of suffering, and he gave teachings suitable to whatever audience he was teaching to, and never recorded as... laying out his some underlying system for this, but after he passed away, people started to systematize his teachings and pulling out the core concepts and arranging them in order and going through the sutras that he'd been teaching, and it got organized into what's called the Abhidharma, which is it's a little like a periodic table that it's these you put in these Buddhist concepts and you're organizing them in a way that indicates some of the relationship. There's wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas and all these other ones. There's 78, they came up with 78 different elements of reality or of human experience and how to organize them. And the path of practice was to really study this thoroughly and memorize these parts and then in your meditation identify dharmas. And some of them are core, like anger and lust and dullness, but also color and shape, some of these things. It is believed to be the core sort of elements, building blocks of reality as far as human experience goes. One of the stories is that Buddha only taught the Abhidharma to one person, and that was Shariputra, who was his disciple, who was foremost in knowledge. And probably more likely from the scholastic point of view is that because Shariputra had this high standing as being foremost of knowledge, when these Abhidharma texts started to get written down, they attributed them to Shariputra. Because again, just giving the text authority, he's the Buddha's foremost student of knowledge. And so whatever the Heart Sutra is doing then is reacting to this scholastic approach, which is kind of reifying the Buddhist teachings, and I'll go more into that. And, you know, skillfully, in order to challenge that, they're challenging Shariputra, right? Because he's the authority on these texts. So it's the argument is placed before Shariputra that, yeah. So, yeah, Thor.
Do I understand correctly that at the time these texts were transmitted already in the codified written form to China, and that the Chinese then translated this from Sanskrit, sutras, and it was also like the scholastic work that was done? Was it translated into Chinese, or?
I don't know about the Abhidharma and the history of that, you know. So I'm talking about the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, actually, in general, you know, being a reaction to the Sarvasivadins. And the Heart Sutra growing out of it's called the Large Sutra. So it's the argument is against the Sarvasivadins. I think once they placed everything into this neat periodic table, then it's it comes with a certain, you know, grasping to these elements as being like this was so the person wasn't real, is Buddha's teachings no self they were on board with, but they believed that these elements, you know, actually being real and existent, and the skandhas, you know, aspects that make up a person being real. So Heart Sutra is a teacher, like, calls it the anti-reification campaign, to sort of, and this is all this no, is, you know, so these are concepts, you know, used, and they're useful as far as they can help us let go, but they're not to be grasped.
It strikes me that that's, I think the term is title of this book, not always so.
And this is a big,
not always so.
Right, yeah. It's exactly. It's it has the use, you know, but it's like, don't grasp it. I mean, we can see that in religion all the time. You know, once the founder goes away, there's a real tendency to grasp after the teachings and grasp tighter and tighter. And I think, you know, Jesus and Muhammad would be horrified if they knew it, that, you know, they're religions that have grown out of their prophecy, how their words are being used right now, I'm sure. So the Sarvasivadins weren't, I don't know of any records of that kind of violence going on, you know. I think it was more a scholastic tradition than a monastic, but there's still this this holding on, and which easily creates other attachments in other ways, and get into that a little later, I think. And so there's a different emphasis too, and the Sarvastivadins theory is this real emphasis on knowledge, of really studying this system thoroughly and getting to know it, and instead the Prajnaparamita is this emphasis on wisdom, and the perfection of wisdom. So the word prajna actually translates to something like before knowledge, what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind, be something akin to that, of actually going beyond analysis of reality into these discrete noble entities and being open to the mystery. This is Zen koan, what is your original face before your parents were born? You know, I think it's pointing to going before knowledge. So I've got pages and pages. No, it's. I think I'll skip some of these little small branches of it. But if you return to the text again, we've already mentioned the some core Buddhist concepts showing up. Any of you see any when you name them? We see if we can identify some of them.
This is being referred to the Four Noble Truths. Is that word? Is that mostly that sense that there's neither ignorance nor extinction of old age, no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path? Is that the
No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path is the Four Noble Truths, yeah. And neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death is another, it's an abbreviation of another core teaching. Does anybody know? Yeah, the Twelvefold Chain. So it's, I think in the Indian text, you know, this section again of the Large Sutra actually has them all written down because that's how they tend to do in India, be very thorough. And the Chinese, you know,
skip to the end.
So the 12-fold chain is, you know, this is the first and last chain in there, just to summarize it.
The English actually has an ellipsis there. Is that in the Chinese?
Yeah, probably not. The three dots.
Before this iteration of the chant, but we used to chant down to neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. So the down to was eliminating all the other.
Anything else? Let's see. The other ones are, you know, the six sense organs, which is, you know, eyes, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So in Buddhism, the mind is considered a sense organ too. And then, together with the six sense organs, got sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and object of mind. An object of mind being a thought, really, what the mind is grasping.
The Abhidharma had this very elaborated theory of perception involved, you know, a sense capacity and you know, coming together with an object.
Yeah.
Very, very elaborate. So.
Yeah, again, it's referring to those. It's called the 12 sense field, you know, the six sense organs and the objects or the sense fields, or ayatanas in Sanskrit. And then there's an abbreviation there with no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. It's the six sense consciousnesses. It makes up together these 18 make up the 12 dhatus, which is realms. Yeah, so.
With all this negation of basic Buddhist teaching, was there at some point early on a reaction against this?
The Heart Sutra?
Like, this is heresy, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, Carl Brunholz, that I've mentioned, he wrote this book. It's a pretty good commentary. His commentary is called the Heart Attached Sutra. And he claims that there's some records that when, you know, that the story, some stories anyway, that when the Heart Sutra was first told, that these arhats would have, you know, nosebleeds and heavy headaches and heart attacks, because it was so shocking that these things that they've been holding on to, you know, really been thinking was real was not. I don't know what the historical, you know, evidences for reaction. Yeah. And it probably was from, you know, the Sarvastivana in this school is not existent anymore. And actually there's some indication that what we're calling Hinayana, is actually referring to the Shravasivadin school. It's not referring to the... We tend to think it's a Theravada, you know, because there's this other major school now. But the Theravada wasn't a fully formed school at the time, and it was the Shravasivadins with, you know, this kind of reification going on the Buddha's teaching and an overly monastic and not wise, you know, spreading that bodhisattvic emphasis that the term Hinayana was referring to.
So, it's also offering liberation to someone on the other side. I mean, it's very clearly the last sentence and also without any humans go into existence. So, there you go.
Yeah.
It's got a promise.
It's got a promise? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's see where we are. So, as also, I'm interested in that the got the this is the Bodhisattva of compassion that's showing up in this, you know, unusual in these wisdom teachings. But it's what's the purpose of this is actually to relieve all suffering and who else plays in there but the Bodhisattva of compassion. He was also more influential in China, more revered in China than in India at this time, which might be another reason, you know, why it might have been a Chinese text and to start with. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, practicing the perfection of wisdom. We got the six paramitas in there too. You know, it's only the perfection of wisdom that's mentioned, but it's referring to the teachings of the six paramitas, which is giving, ethics, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. Yeah.
It's interesting though that you know the paramitas are sort of implicit in there, but they're also the only thing that's not needed.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? It's partly because they're a Mahayana teaching and not, yeah, it's not something that the Savastivadins were clinging to because it wasn't, yeah, in their school. But it's perfection of, you know, the perfection is a term to distinguish it from other kinds of knowledge that we might refer to as wisdom, you know, being just how we see the world in our everyday life, and we think we know one object for another. The second one being a more metaphysical one, and I think it's applied by the Shravasivadins of seeing what seems to be permanent, you know, is impermanent, and applying these concepts onto it. And then the perfection of wisdom is sort of going beyond these concepts.
This concept of all Buddhas, was that a controversial thing to say at that point? Is that also a reaction? Like, I don't know if that idea at that time in the first century CE of, like, you know, thinking of Buddha as something beyond just the historical Buddha.
Yeah, I think it comes into with the Mahayana of there being, you know, the Buddhas before Buddhas, and you know, going back, and it's also the ideal in the Hinayana was, you know, there was the Buddha that awoke, you know, and for everybody else it was the arhatship of escaping the, you know, suffering, and the Mahayana ideal being the one of the Bodhisattva relieving suffering, but you know, through incalculable eons, you're destined for Buddhahood too. So that it's Buddhahood isn't an exclusive thing. Just going back to the historical Buddha, it's a, you know, much wider and cosmic concept. Yeah, Abel. Sorry, about the knowledge?
Yeah, facing the knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think in some way, you know, it's not disregarding it. It's actually, and even though it's the easy with the heart sutra saying all these no, to think that all these teachings are not important anymore. And it's, I think, not what it's saying, but, you know, these are still important concepts and they're helpful in the sense that they might help us wake up, but to go beyond there and not to, you know, enlightenment is not in the, you know, in the end of it, it's not an intellectual, something intellectual, you know, grasping it with our intellect is not a deep enough understanding. So wisdom is going deeper and beyond knowledge. We can study the text and all that we want, but have a sophisticated understanding of them intellectually, but it only takes us so far, and it might become a hindrance if you start grasping at this as being real. Yeah.
It's so scary, like, going off the
ledge.
Yeah. There's no
ledge. Yeah. That's why these arhats were having heart attacks.
Yeah. A place where I'm wondering about that is about 2/3 of the way down, far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. And I mean, that's a statement about beyond views, but what are inverted? Why are these views called inverted?
Yeah. This lopsided, upside down understanding of how, you know, of what reality is, and I've got them in. It's like believing that the permanent, the impermanent is permanent, and the, you know, the non-self is self, that the impure is pure, and the fourth one too. Let's see if I can. Inverted views. Oh, believing that what is impermanent to be permanent, the unpleasurable to be pleasurable, no self to be self, and impure to be pure. This is just a standard Buddhist teaching. And since I'm just going to dive into the text a little more, but maybe this is a good spot to just take a bathroom break if you need, and I think we've got some tea out there, and we'll come back and chant the Makahanya Haramita Shingyo. Thank you.